Okay, this class is sponsored by Nomi Chernov in memory of her mother, Pearl Ostrov, Pnina Bat Chaim, Zichrona Livracha, and we be blessed with good health and long life. Amen. And of course, we are always davening for our soldiers, for our hostages, for refuah of everyone who needs it, refuat ha-nefesh, refuat ha-guf. We've had a week where we need a lot of refuat ha-nefesh, and besorot tovot. Okay, so really, this is a little bit incorrect, this title, because half of the class that we're going to do today is stuff that we have still left over from last time, which is all sorts of unusual personalities and characters. But the second half is going to be about women. The picture here, by the way, if people recognize it, is the gorgeous, what's called the Mona Lisa of the Galil. This is a beautiful mosaic that was found in a very elegant home in Tsipori. Hey, some people suggest that it's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's home. It seems very unlikely because it's a mosaic that also includes a whole ritual of Dionysus, the god of wine. But it does have this beautiful woman in the middle, and there have been all kinds of interesting speculations. Is she the lady of the house, right? But just to see something like this made out of mosaic stones, it's really kind of extraordinary. And we always like to have depictions of women and of men because we don't have so many pictures, right, to understand what people look like. But I just put her here because we're going to be talking about some women. We have women in rabbinic literature. Most of them are anonymous, right? We hear about women who show up in court cases. We hear about women who are giving medicine, or having various issues that they come to the rabbis. We don't hear about them with their names. Occasionally we get a name, property owners, right? Different kinds of people. Really not enough to be able to understand women as a whole. However, we do have some women who are named, who are significant. They are almost always women who are married to important rabbis. And we're going to look at a couple of these, we'll call them power couples, as we go along, after we finish with our men. But I would like to say here, because it's just fantastic, I highly recommend, I'm going to be quoting from it in one of our couples. This is an amazing new book. Gila Fine, who's a wonderful scholar, teaches in Pardes, and she just wrote this book called The Mad Woman in the Rabbi's Attic, where she takes various rabbinic stories about women, famous women, Yalta, Bruria, Choma, right? Different people, and she completely just reads them in a fascinating way. I really can't recommend it enough. So if you like this kind of stuff, this is the book for you. I recommend. Available through Koren, Magid, which is really Koren. Okay, I don't get a commission. Moving along. So let's go back to what we were doing from last time. And that's really, like I said, our first, really the first half of the class. So if you remember last time, we had various personalities. We talked about Acher. We talked about Ben Azai. So here we have another interesting, also a pair. A really fascinating pair. One of them is much more famous than the other. Okay, we have a father and son, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Rashbi, and his son, Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, I think, does not really need an introduction. We hear about him all over the place. He is the most prominent figure in the Zohar, okay, written much, much later than his time period, but we certainly can think that some of these are traditions that have been passed down. I'm going to put the sources in the chat once more for people who want them. Thank you for whoever wrote the name of the book. Okay, here's the sources in the chat again. Okay, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, a mystic, but a rabbi who lives in the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt, probably most famous because he speaks out against the Romans. He is sentenced to death, and he escapes and he lives in a cave for many years with his son, Rabbi Elazar, right? And this is a story that I assume many of us are familiar with. It's the first story that we have here. First source, Rabbi Yehuda opened and said, "How pleasant are the actions of this nation, the Romans, right? What have the Romans done for us lately? They established marketplaces, established bridges, established bathhouses, right? Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, talking about the material culture of the Romans, which was very good, was very useful. They made roads, they did all these things that are very useful. Rabbi Yossi was silent. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai responded and said, everything that they established for their own purposes. Marketplaces to put prostitutes in, bathhouses to pamper themselves, bridges to collect taxes from them. And the story goes on, of course, that a price is essentially put on Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's head. He first hides out kind of close to home, but he's very nervous that his wife is going to be tortured and give up his place of hiding. So he takes his son, and together they go off and they hide in a cave, and they are fed magically from a carob tree that springs. Carob tree or date palm? I'm
Carob tree.
remembering. Palm tree, right? Okay, I knew that I was mixing it up. Okay. And this is a picture of the cave that is traditionally said to be the cave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in Pekin in the north. And they stay there for a very long time till they hear that the Roman emperor who wanted to kill them has died, and they emerge. But when they emerge, they come out, and they've been so transfixed, transformed by this experience that they can't cope with anything physical, right? And if you look, skip the middle one here, a divine voice emerged and said, "Emerge from your cave." They emerge, right? This is the second time. The first time they come out, everywhere they look, Rabbi Shimon puts things on fire because he can't deal with like a physicality. How can people be working and not learning Torah? The second time, they spend another year in the cave, and then they could come out. Everywhere that Rabbi Elazar would strike, Rabbi Shimon would heal. And we have this kind of a partner, I don't know, partnership, but they're a pair. Okay? They're together. If you look at the source that we skipped over here in Sukkah, okay, Chizkiyahu said that Rabbi Yirmiyah said in the name of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, "I have seen people who are elite, right? And they are few. If they number 1,000, my son and I are among them. If they number 100, I and my son are among them. If they number 2, I and my son are they." Okay? So they are, first of all, have a healthy sense of self-confidence, self-worth, but they go together. Okay, and that's what we see in Shabbat. Everywhere Rabbi Elazar would strike, Rabbi Shimon would heal. They seem to be very similar, but as time goes on and we have more stories, we have a set of very strange stories in Bava Metzia. That's the last two sources that we have here. Very bizarre stories about Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon. There's been a lot of literary analysis of them, but essentially they contrast the two of them. The two of them who become so close, they spend 12 years together studying Torah in the cave all day long, no contact with other people, but in the later stories, we see contrast. So, if Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, sorry, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is so anti-Roman, right? He everything the Romans do, they do for themselves, okay? And presumably Rabbi Elazar is with him on that. That's why he goes hide out with him. But then later on, Rabbi Elazar collaborates with the Romans, and that's the story that we have in Bava Metzia, where they're trying to catch thieves, and he says, "I know how to catch thieves." And they say, "Well, if you're so good at it, why don't you work for us?" And he essentially works for the Romans to catch thieves. And this is the last source that we have here. They brought Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, and he proceeded to arrest thieves. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha sent to Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, the following message: "You are vinegar, son of wine." Okay, this is a theme that goes over and over again. Fathers, sons. Who's good? Who's bad? Are you a righteous father of a not righteous son, or the other way around? So vinegar son of wine means your father was great. You are nothing. Until when will you inform on the nation of God to be sentenced to execution? Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, sent a message back. "I am merely eradicating thorns from the vineyard." Okay. I know who the bad guys are, and I'm getting rid of them. I'm turning them over to the authority. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha sent back to him, "Let the owner of the vineyard, i.e., God, come and eradicate his own thorns." Okay, so here we have our first contrast. Rabbi Elazar is helping the Romans, he's aiding and abetting, and Rabbi Shimon will have nothing to do with the Romans. Second contrast, Rabbi Shimon is very much an ascetic, and the truth is, when they're in the cave, the two of them are ascetics. What do they eat? They eat the dates, they drink the water, and that's it. Only what comes from God. But in these later stories in Bava Metzia, Rabbi Elazar has these enormous appetites. Okay? eats a ton. There's all kinds of stories that have to do with blood and his stomach and what he eats. And everything connected to him is very, very physical, right? Even the questions that are asked to him, they all have to do with the body or with death or with sex, right? It's all very, very, very physical. It seems very much contrasted to Rabbi Shimon. I don't have such an answer for what's going on here, but I do think that it's fascinating. They are definitely counterposed one to the other. And we have this other, again, our this one son of that one, right? Rabbi Yehuda Nasi has a clash with Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says he's so much better than him. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi became offended. He came and told his father, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, his father, said to him, "My son, do not let his actions offend you. He is a lion, son of a lion, and you are a lion, son of a fox." Remember, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is very modest. He says, "Rabbi Elazar, he had a great father, and he's great. You're great, but your father, he's not so important," right? Meaning he's saying it about himself. But the story seemed to indicate that maybe Rabbi Elazar is a fox, son of a lion, right? Very interesting. When you get to the Zohar, and I am not going to get to the Zohar because, as you all probably know, I am not a mystic, but in the Zohar, both Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Elazar are very important. They're very significant. And this, the counterpoint between them, I think, is fascinating. The other picture that you have down here, the end of the Gemara in Bava Metzia, talks about where Rabbi Elazar is buried, how his wife keeps him in the house even after he's dead. I'm telling you, you want to read weird stories, go to Bava Metzia 83 and 84. But it talks about where he's buried. Today, the tradition is that Rabbi Elazar is buried with Rabbi Shimon in Meron, and that's the picture that you have here. So very unusual, very interesting character. Okay, moving along. No, why are we not moving along? Here we go. Sorry. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is a less complicated character, but he is an unusual character. Hey, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is from the generation that's like a transition. Hey, he's connected to Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's family. He studies with Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. He's considered a Tana, even though he's an Amoro. We have a few people like that in that transitional generation. So we hear about him like he's quoted in the Mishnah. He's quoted in Pirkei Avot, even though he's not really of the generation of the Tanaim. He lived and he taught in the city of Lod. Okay? He was wealthy and influential, and the Romans recognized that too. Right? If you look at the first source here, Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi appeared before the proconsul of Caesarea. He saw them and rose before them. They said to him, "You get up before these Jews?" Said to them, "I saw the faces of angels." Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is known. He has a lot of agada, a lot of agadata. He has halacha too, but the agadata is really, I think, what he's most known for. He very much believes in the power of Torah. Torah is a protection, right? Torah Meginah Umatzilah. And we have this Gemara here in Ketubot, where it talks about people staying away from people who have this terrible disease, Ratan. And this one would go away when he saw them, and this one would do this. And Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi would attach himself to them and study Torah, right? He says, he quotes from Mishle, "A loving hind and a graceful doe, if it bestows grace on those who learn it, does it not protect?" Meaning, Torah protects us. It's a theme we hear a lot in Israel these days, right? Torah protects us. And he actually, I think my favorite quote of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is about Torah learning through the generations. And that's the Yerushalmi that we have up here, Yerushalmi Shabbat. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi was used to hearing the lesson of his grandson every Friday, right? Every Friday, sit and learn Torah with his grandson, right? Beautiful. Once he forgot and went bathing in the public bath of Tveria. He was leaning on Rabbi Chiya bar Abba's shoulder. He remembered that he had not heard his grandson's lesson, and he turned around and left. Right? Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said, "Did our teacher not say, teach us if they started, they should not interrupt?" Right? "How are you leaving the bathhouse in the middle when you're running out the door?" He said to him, "Chiya, my son, is that unimportant in your eyes? Anyone who hears a lesson from his grandson, it is as if he heard it from Sinai." Right? It's a beautiful grandparent, grandchild, right? Meaning, obviously, he's probably a doting grandfather, but it's more the idea of the connection, the chain of generations. You have to hear one generation to the next. Beautiful, beautiful story. And there's a whole series of Agadotot. I didn't bring them here, but about Moshe Rabbeinu going up to the heavens to get the Torah, and the angels challenge, and they say to God, "Why are you giving this mortal the Torah? Shouldn't you give it to the angels?" And Hashem doesn't answer them. Hashem says, "Moshe, you answer them, right?" And in the words of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, right, Moshe says to the angels, "Now it says, Zachorat Yom HaShabbat. Do you work that you need to rest?" Right? It says, "Oh, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hoceiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim." Did you get out of Egypt? Right? And Moshe shows them that the Torah is really for humans and it's not at all for angels. Probably the most famous story about Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is how he gets into Gan Eden without dying. Okay, and it's a long story. I only brought you one piece of it, and this is the Gemara here in Ketubot. When Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi was dying, they said to the angel of death, "Go and perform his bidding." Meaning, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is a really holy guy, so even the angel of death has to listen to him. The angel of death went and appeared to him. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said to him, "Show me my place in paradise. I want to see where I'm going to get to go." He said to him, "Very well." Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said to him, "Give me your knife, lest you frighten me on the way." He gave it to him. When he arrived there, he lifted Rabbi Yeshua and he showed it to him. Rabbi Yeshua jumped and fell into the other side, right? He got into Gan Eden while he was still alive, and he takes the knife and then he has to give it back to him, right? It's a great story. It's such a great story that Henry Wadsworth Longfellow heard this story from some old Jewish Sephardi guy. He thought this was such a great story that he wrote a poem called The Legend of Ben Levi about this. And actually, recently, somebody made it into a book with great illustrations. So it's actually a fascinating thing. But that brings us to another really interesting story. Up in the north in Tzipori, right? Tzipori, not in Tzipori. Well, yeah, in Tzipori, sorry. Not in the ancient part of Tzipori, but in the modern Moshav of Tzipori, which is right next door. There's a guy named Mitch Pilser who has beautiful cabins, tzimmerim, places that you can come for a vacation. A few years ago, he was expanding. He wanted to make a pool for the people who came on vacation. And while he was digging the pool, he came upon what you see in the picture here. Okay. And this is a door to a grave. Okay. This is something that we know. We see it from Second Temple times, from Mishnah times, from Gemara times, that there were burial caves with an actual door. And this door had writing on it. It's very hard to see it in the photograph, but you can see on the bottom, right? Hare Mishkava de Rabbi Yoshua bar Levi Kapra or Safra Hadan Mishkava, excuse me. This is the resting place of Rabbi Yoshua bar Levi, Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. Safra, Kafra, right? A sofer, a kofer, somebody who makes capers, unclear, but it for sure says Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. And he was very, very excited, Mitch Pilser, to discover this, as would anybody. He told the Antiquities Authority, and the Antiquities Authority wanted to take it. They wanted to take it and bring it to their warehouses or put it in the museum. And he said, No, I want it. I want Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi's chut to protect me. I don't want to give this up." And they said, "Well, we're so sorry, but we have to take it." And he went to the Atra Kadisha. The Atra Kadisha is the Haredi society that whenever there are excavations and they find burial, they'll come and they'll protest and they'll not allow anybody to move bones or to move graves. So he went to the Atra Kadisha. He said, "I need your help. I want to keep this here." And they said to him, "We're so sorry. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi lo mate. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi never died. He got into Gan Eden alive. So clearly he doesn't have a grave, and therefore we can't help you," which I think is just a fantastic story. Now, is this really Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi's grave? We have never heard in rabbinic literature that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi has this last, this title, this profession, Safra, Kafra. So that makes it a little bit questionable. Very interesting, in Beit Sha'arim, not far from Tzipori, right? Beit Sha'arim, Rabbi's home, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's home, where he's buried and many other people were buried. We have a sarcophagus. We have a few sarcophagi, actually. Three inscriptions that seem to indicate, perhaps, that this is where Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is, right? The first one says, "Ha'aron hazeh bito shel Rabbi Yehoshua Zecher Tzadikim Livracha. This is the sarcophagus of the daughter of Rabbi Yoshua, Zecher Tzadikim Livracha. That's one. The second one says, Zo Aronosha Rabbi Yoshua Ha. It's cut off, right? This is the sarcophagus of Rabbi Yoshua. And this is the Arona Shel Kira Maga Ishto Shel Rabbi Yoshua Ben Levi Shalom. Okay, so first of all, we have Rabbi Yoshua. We have the whole family. We have him as a Zecher Tzadik Livracha. We have the inscription in Hebrew and not in Aramaic, which would seem to connect to Rabbi Yoshua and to his holiness. And also it's in Beit Sha'arim, and Rabbi Yoshua was connected by family to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and so Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is buried. So there are those who say, no, Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi is buried in Beit Sha'arim. Either way, really, really interesting stories. Okay, moving right along in time, okay? Rabbi Zeira is an Amora. It's a Babylonian Amora, third generation. His main teacher is Rav Yehuda, right? Rav Yehuda in Pumbedita. Rav Yehuda was a lover of the land of Israel, but he did not believe that people should make aliyah to Israel, which sounds very counterintuitive, right? It sounds very strange. But he believed that God decreed that we have to, he brought us to Babel into exile, and until he brings us out of there, we have to stay there. Okay? This is an idea that the Satmar have today, right? And he did not want his students to go to Eretz Yisrael. And we have a couple of students. Rabbi Zera is one of them. Rabbi Abba is another one who have to sneak out. They have to sneak away because they don't want their teacher to know that they're going. Right. So here, if you look at the second source, here's Rabbi Yehuda says, anyone who ascends from Babylonia to Eretz Yisrael transgresses a positive commandment. As it is stated, they shall be taken to Babylonia and they shall remain there until the day that I recall them, said the Lord. Babela yuv'u v'shama yiyu ad yom pokdiotam. Right. You stay. But Rabbi Zeira wants to go to Eretz Yisrael. His deepest desire is to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he says this in a few places. I brought you one, right? The first source here. Rabbi Zeira said, may it be God's will that I merit to ascend to Eretz Yisrael. And I learn this halacha from the mouth of its master, Rabbi Elazar, right? He wants to learn from the teachers of Eretz Yisrael. He wants to live in Eretz Yisrael. He finally makes it. He sneaks out of Babylonia. Strange idea, but he does. Okay. And he gets to the eastern side of the Jordan and he has to cross over. Now, normally cross over the Jordan, you need a ferry boat, right? It's deep today, not so deep, but in those days, much deeper. We didn't divert the waters of the Jordan. And we have this great story at the end of Ketubot. The end of Ketubot is all about stories that are extolling the beauty and the produce and the importance of Eretz Yisrael. So this is one of the stories. When Rabbi Zeira ascended to Eretz Yisrael, he could not find a ferry to cross, right? There was nobody crossing him. So what did he do? He took hold of a rope and crossed the Jordan. I want you to picture something like a zip line, right? A rope that is extended, connected to poles on either side, on either bank of the Jordan, and you cross over holding onto it so that you don't fall into the water. A certain Sadducee said to him, hasty people who put your mouths before your ears, right? He says, you are an Amah Paziza. You went, right? Last week's Parsha, Am Yisrael saying, Naaseh v'nishma, right? We said we're going to do it even before we heard what it is to do. So you're so hasty. You're so, what's the word that I want, right? You don't think things through. That's not the word I want, but you know what I mean. Rabbi Zeira said to him, a place where Moses and Aaron did not merit entering? Who is to say that I will merit? Rabbi Zeira said, great tzaddikim didn't make it into Eretz Yisrael. I don't want to take any chances. I'm going to get in while I can. Now, the great part of this story, it's a great story, but even better than that is what you have over here. This is a section of a very famous map called the Medva map. We looked at it in other classes. Right? It's a mosaic map that was found on the floor of a church in Jordan, a place called Medva. It's a map, a very detailed map of the land of Israel. Not all of it is in good shape, but a lot of it is. The most famous part of it is the part of Jerusalem. But this, and it's from the 5th, 6th century. Okay, so a little bit after Rabbi Zeira, but not too much. And here you have The lovely flowing Jordan. It's got nice big fish in it. Okay. The eastern side of the Jordan and the western side of the Jordan. But what do you have on the going across the Jordan? You have a metzra. You have this rope that Rashi explains that this is what this is, that it's a rope strung across with poles on either side. So clearly Rabbi Zera did not invent this idea. This was something that was done to get across from one side to another. And here we have it in the mosaic, right? So it's just a really nice little detail of the story. Now, when Rabbi Zera comes to Eretz Yisrael, he is the ultimate Olech Hadash. He's a new immigrant. I owe this insight to my very smart neighbor, Dr. Benny Gesundheit, who wrote a whole article about this. Rabbi Zeira is a new immigrant. First of all, he gets cheated, right? New immigrants get cheated all the time. And he gets duped, and that's this very sad story in the Yerushalmi and Brachot. He wanted to buy a pound of red meat from the butcher. He asked him how much is the pound. He said to him, 50 mina and one slap. I have to slap you if you want to have this meat. He said to him, take 60, do not slap me, but he didn't accept. Take 70, but he didn't accept. Take 80, take 90, till he came to 100, he did not accept. He said, do what is your routine, right? This is what you do. Okay, this is what you do. The next morning, he went to the academy and said to them, rabbis, what is this bad practice here? That nobody can eat a pound of red meat unless they slap him. And obviously, all the other rabbis laughed at him and said, this is not what we do, right? But he's duped. And he so much wants to be part of the country, of the culture, right? When Rabbi Zeira ascended to Eretz Yisrael, he fasted 100 fasts so that he would forget the Babylonian method of studying Gemara so that it would not hinder him. He wants to be a part, and eventually he is, right? He is in a lot of different ways. He really becomes part of the Talmudic culture of Eretz Yisrael. One very simple way, right? Rabbis in Babylonia are usually called Rav, like Rav Yehuda or Rav Nachman. Rabbis in Eretz Yisrael are called Rabbi, like Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi or Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Zeira is called Rabbi Zeira. He becomes an Eretz Yisrael rabbi. When he dies, we have this very beautiful obituary that's said about him. Okay. The land of Shinar, which is Babylonia, conceived and gave birth to him, but the land of beauty, right, Eretz HaTzvi, Eretz Yisrael, raised the darling of Babylonia. He might have come from Babylonia, but he is now one of us. He's one of Eretz Yisrael, right? And he even goes to the point, and Olim Chadashim or Olim Vatikim do this also, where he praises the land of Israel, says the air of Eretz Israel makes you wise, Avirat Eretz Israel Melchakim, and he makes fun of the Babylonians, right? American immigrant making fun of America. Bavlai Tipshai, you stupid Babylonians. So he completely adopts his new culture. So that's Rabbi Zeira, a very interesting character. Okay. I'm gonna do one more and then we'll do a little rabbi confusion. Okay. This is Rabbi Yosef. Okay, Rabbi Yosef is also third generation Amora, also a student of Rabbi Yehuda. He does not want to leave Babylonia. He very much, loves the Torah of Eretz Yisrael, but he wants to stay in Eretz Yisrael. He's called Sinai, right? He's called Sinai as opposed to his contemporary Rava, who's called Oker Harim. Okay? Sinai means he knows all the Torah from Sinai. He's an encyclopedia of Torah, right? Rava is Oker Harim. Oker Harim means he can do all of these pilpul and logic and figuring things out, but he doesn't have the breadth of knowledge that Rav Yosef has. And he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva eventually of Pumbedita. We'll get to his forgetfulness in a second, but his students are Abaye and Rava, right? His contemporaries Rabba, but his students are Abaye and Rava, and they have great, great respect for him. Okay, take a look at this source down here. When Rava took leave of Rav Yosef, he would walk backwards until his legs were bruised and the threshold of Rav Yosef's house was bloodied, right? He just has so much respect for him. But Rav Yosef has this terrible thing happen to him. He has two terrible things happen to him. He goes blind, okay? And he becomes ill and he forgets a lot of his Torah. And what's, I think, really fascinating about Rav Yosef is despite these two things, these two huge impediments, right? So we think here's this person who really, it's a tragic story. He's a brilliant man. He knows so much and he loses it. He forgets it, but he's not tragic. So first of all, let's see, the different sources about him. First of all, this first one here is just great because he recognizes that all the honor that he gets and all the respect that he gets is because of the Torah, right? Rav Yosef on the day of Shavuot would say, "Prepare me a choice third-born calf." He said, "If not for this day on which the Torah was given, that caused the Jewish people to have the Torah, how many Yosefs would there be in the market?" Meaning, why am I special? I'm special because I know Torah. It's not that there's anything wonderful about me in and of myself. So he's very much like recognizing and acknowledging that the Torah is where he gets his respect and his power from. He's blind. We hear about that in a bunch of places. Take a look at the second to last source here. Rav Yosef said, "At first, I would say, if someone would tell me that the halacha is in accordance with the opinion of Rav Yehuda, who says a blind person is exempt from fulfilling the mitzvot, I would make a festive day for the rabbis, as I am not commanded, and yet I perform." Okay, so we have this very interesting discussion in the Gemara in Kiddushin. Gadol ha-mitzuveh ba'oseh or gadol she'eino mitzuveh ba'oseh? Is it better to do the mitzvot because you are commanded to do them? And this comes up with women, certain mitzvot. Or is it better to do them even though you aren't commanded to do them, right? And ultimately, we say the halacha is gadol ha-mitzuveh ba'oseh. It's a greater thing to do the mitzvot when you are commanded, meaning you're obligated. You have to do it. You don't have no way out. And that's greater than someone who just says, "Oh, today I'm going to do it. Tomorrow I'm not." So Rav Yosef says, "Oh, is a blind person chayav, right, or exempt?" So if it's a person is exempt, and we say gadol she'eino mitzuveh ba'oseh, then that's great. I'll be so happy, right? But if the idea is gadol mitzuvevo said, then I'm in trouble because it's not as great. But here we hear that he's blind, right? We know that he's blind. We also hear that he forgets. He has some illness, and there's been a lot of ink spilled over what this illness is exactly, right? But if you look here, we have a bunch of different sources where he forgets things. Okay, so take a look at this one here from Nedarim. Rav Yosef fell ill and his studies were forgotten. Abaye restored his studies before him. That is why everywhere we say, Rav Yosef said, "I did not learn this halacha," and Abaye said to him, "You said this to us," right? And we have an even more of an example of this up here in the Gemara in Eruvin. Rav Yosef said, "Rav Yehuda Nasi teaches if there are three, they are prohibited from carrying without an Eruv." Rav Bivai said to the sages, "Do not listen to him. He is mistaken. I told it to him, and I told it in the name of Rav Ada Bar Ava, not Rav Yehuda Hanasi." When he heard this, Rav Yosef said in astonishment, "Master of Abraham," right? It's like an exclamation. "I mistook the word Rebbe for the word Rabim." Okay. And Rashi explains that when I forgot the matter in my illness. Now, what's fascinating is that we have a bunch of places where this happens. Rabbi Yosef says, "I don't know this halacha. I don't remember this halacha." And Abaye, his very loyal student, says, "No, Rebbe. Right, this is what you taught us. Don't you remember?" Right, it's what we have in the Nedarim. "Don't you remember, Rebbe? You said this to us." And he gives him back his Torah. And he's not a tragic figure because, well, first of all, because it seems like he gets his knowledge back towards later in his life, which is very interesting, like what this illness is. But also because his students treat him with so much respect and they respect him even when he's lost his Torah, because of what he had before. And that's why you have this beautiful Gemara in Menachot, which Rav Yosef teaches, and it could apply to him, right? Rav Yosef teaches a Braita. Both the tablets of the covenant and the pieces of the broken tablets are placed in the ark. Luchot v'shivrei luchot nimtzaim ba'aron, right? Remember, Moshe breaks the luchot. The broken and the whole are in the aron. One should learn from here that with regard to a Torah scholar who has forgotten his Torah knowledge due to circumstances beyond his control, one may not behave toward him in a degrading manner. So Rav Yosef teaches it, but we really learn it from Abaye and Rava, who are the students who keep on giving him respect even when he's lost his Torah. So reveals a very, very powerful figure and powerful lesson. Okay, two more before we get to our women. We don't always know, right? Anyone who learns Mishnah or learns Gemara, it's sometimes confusing. The names, because we have a lot, as we saw last time, we talked about names. We have a lot of Shimons. We have a lot of Yehudas. We have a lot of Eliezers. Which one are we talking about? Usually we can figure it out from the context, from different kinds of things. Plus we know, right? Rabbi Yehuda Stam in the Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, right? We have certain things, but sometimes we're confused, right? And I'm bringing you two examples of confusion. We have two Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, right? Which is already unusual. His name and his father's name are the same, right? Not only that, but both Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakovs are described in the same way. They are described as Mishnato Kav Vinaki. Kav v'naki, meaning kav is not a very big measurement. So you don't have a lot of his teachings, but they're naki. They're always correct. They're always accurate. So we have two different ones. One is Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, who lives in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. And Masechet Midot, a lot of the teachings that we have about the Beis HaMikdash come from Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, right? So here we have Rav Huna said, who is the Tana who taught the Mishnayot in Tractate Midot? Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. And we have all these things that he tells us about the Beit HaMikdash and things he remembers from the Beit HaMikdash. We have this one great one, which talks about how, in the nighttime, when the Levi'im, there were supposed to be Levi'im who were staying awake, who were on like guard duty, and there was a guy who would walk around to make sure they were awake, and if not, they would, yell at them. And Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, once they found my mother's brother asleep and they burnt his clothes, right? Not so great, right? Rabbi Shimon ben Azai said, I found a scroll recording people's lineages in Jerusalem, and it said the teachings of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov are a kav vinaki. That's what we said. Okay, so we've got one who lives in the time of Beis HaMikdash, but then we hear about Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, who lives in the time of Usha. Usha is after the time period of the Bar Kokhba revolt. That's a very different time period. Okay, that's 100 years later. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov entered and expanded. How do we know this? Because when the sages gather together in Usha to start to kind of recoup after the Bar Kokhba revolt and the devastation of the Bar Kokhba revolt, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is the one who like welcomes everybody, right? Moses and the priests, the Levites spoke to Israel saying, pay attention. This day you have become a people. Was it that day that they had received the Torah? Had it not been 40 years already since they received the Torah? Rather, it teaches that since Moshe reviewed the Torah for them and they received it welcomingly, the Torah ascribed them credit as though they had received it that day from Mount Sinai. That is why it is stated, this day you will become a people to the Lord your God. You are brethren, residents of Usha, who hospitably welcomed our rabbis, all the more so. So here's Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov 100 years later, right? And he's also Kav v'naki. Take a look. It is taught in a Braita that Isi ben Yehuda will recount the praises of the sages, Rabbi Meir, a scholar and a scribe, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Mishnato, Kav v'naki. He's the same generation as Rabbi Meir, the time period post Bar Kokhba. Which one is which? We can't always tell. Sometimes we can tell based on the context, like in the Mishnah and Midot, we can't always tell. Add to that in the north, in the Galil, near a place called Kfar Hananya, we have a grave of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Kavinaki, right? And he's right next to another grave of someone named Zachariah Katzav, Zachariah ben HaKatzav, who is also from Second Temple times. So maybe this is our Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov number one. But if so, why would he be in the Galil? Why wouldn't he be near Yerushalayim? Sounds more like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov number two. We don't know. So we'll finish with a nice story of whichever one we don't know who, but it's still a nice story. A blind man came to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's town. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov sat below him so that they should say if he were not a great person, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov would not sit below him, right? He wanted to honor this guy, so he sat in a lower place. Everybody would say, ah, oh, this must be a really great man. They provided for him in honor, right? They helped this blind man. He asked them, what is this? They told him, because Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov sat below you. He prayed for him the following prayer. You did a good deed for one who is seen but does not see. He who sees but is not seen, i.e., God, may be appeased by you and do good for you. All right, very beautiful blessing that he got. Okay, and another mystery, many kahanas. This is a very strange Gemara that we have in Erevin, where we have this long string of kahanas. Rav Kahana bar Tachlifa said in the name of Rav Kahana bar Minyumi, who said in the name of Rav Kahana bar Makyu, who said in the name of Rav Kahana, the teacher of Rav. Some say Rav Kahana bar Makyu is Rav Kahana, the teacher of Rav, right? It's not important to us at this point what they're teaching, but we've got one, two, three, four Rav Kahanas, and then we have a fifth one. Rav Kahana said, since this involves halachot of sages named Kahana, I too will say something in regard to it. That's rather a funny thing to say, right? Now, they're confusing. Even Rav Margoliot, right, who wrote the great, very, very useful work of the Encyclopedia of Chachmei HaMishnah VaHaTalmud, and if you want to know about people, he's the guy you go to. Even he was confused by the Kahanas. There are too many of them. It's unclear. They're different. Some are from the first generation of the Amoraim. They go all the way up to the fifth generation, to the time of right before Rav Ashi. One of the things he says that's interesting is that not all of them, despite their names, not all of them are Kohanim. And I brought you a picture of a Kohanim's grave. Not all of them are Kohanim. One of them, it says that he ate from Truma because his wife was the daughter of a Kohen, not because he was a Kohen. The most famous Rav Kahana is a Rav Kahana who's a contemporary of Rav, and he has this very crazy story where he's defending Rav's honor, and he kills somebody, and Rav says to him, "You better get out of here because you're going to be, you're going to be on the run. You're going to be captured, right? The Persians are the Greeks who are in charge are going to catch you and execute you. Get up and ascend to Eretz Yisrael. Accept upon yourself. You will not raise any difficulties to the statements of Rabbi Yochanan." He goes, and we have a whole story of Rabbi Yochanan, which we'll skip because we want to get to our ladies. But if you want to see the story, Bava Kamma 117b, interesting story. But I want us to have a little time for our stories about women. So again, we are some of the stuff that I'm going to bring here is connected to what Gila Fine said in her book. Others, just my own things. We're going to go in chronological order. Our first power couple, hey, Marta bat Baitus and Yoshua ben Gamla. Again, confusing. Hey, when do we have these two characters? Right, we have a bunch of different sources about both of them. Hey, unclear if they are at the time of the Churban, which is clearly the last story that we have here about Marta bat Baitus, or at an earlier time period. Hey, Josephus writes about Yoshua ben Gamla that he's in the time of the Churban, but we also hear about Marta and Yoshua in the time of King Yanai, which is the time of the Hashmonaim. So the time period is confusing. But we have a very interesting portrait of these people. Hey, Marta bat Baitus, you could tell from her name, Baitus was one of the very prominent families of the Kohanim, not a particularly nice family, right? As we can see from the Gemara here in Pesachim, right? Abba Shaul ben Botnitz said in the name of Abba Yossi ben Chanin, "Woe to me, to the high priest of the house of Baitus. Woe is me due to their clubs," right? This is this lament about the different houses of the Kohanim and how they were corrupt and how they would terrorize the people and not good, right? So Marta ben Baitus comes from this house. And that fits with the story that we have in the Mishnah and the Gemara in Yevamot. Okay, take a look here at the top. If a priest betrothed a widow and was subsequently appointed to be high priest, he may marry her. There was an incident with Yoshua ben Gamla, who betrothed Martha ben Baitus, a widow, and the king subsequently appointed him to be high priest and nevertheless married her, right? We know the Kohen Gadol has to be married, cannot be married to a widow or a divorcee. But here the Mishnah says, if he's engaged to her and then he's appointed to be the Kohen Gadol, he can marry her after all. And the example is Marta and Yoshua ben Gamla. Okay, that's a pretty innocuous story. But the Gemara goes on and adds a little bit more spicy details. Rav Asi said, Marta bat Baitus brought a vessel the size of a half se'ah full of dinars to King Yanai, until he appointed Yoshua ben Gamla high priest, meaning how is he appointed to be the Kohen Gadol? She bribes the king, which is not at all an uncommon story at the end of Second Temple times, right? We hear that in a lot of different places. But what does it tell us? It tells us that Martha is wealthy, okay? And it tells us that she's not so scrupulous. She is following in the ways of her family. But on the other hand, we have strange, like complimentary stories about Yoshua ben Gamla. Hey, Yoshua ben Gamla made the lotteries for the lots for the Seir Lazazel and the Seir LaHashem. They were originally made out of wood. Yoshua ben Gamla made them out of gold. We have an even nicer story. I didn't bring it here for you. That Yoshua ben Gamla is the one who does a whole educational reform and make sure that even people who don't have a lot of money, even kids who don't have a lot of money, can study. So good guy, bad guy, when does he live? Very unclear. But Martha, she doesn't have too many positive gemaras about her. She's very, very rich. We hear about how she would, you know, when she would go out in the street, they would lay carpets on the ground so that she wouldn't have to step on the ground. When she goes to the Beit Din, right, as a widow to get her ketubah, to get the allowance that she should have for, you know, her upkeep, right, for her food. So she went, and there's a whole discussion in ketubot. Are women given wine as part of their, like, you know, their daily rations? So the sages assigned to Martha Bavaitis 2 se'ah of wine every day. That's a lot of wine. Okay? Nevertheless, she cursed them and said to them, "So you should give to your daughters. Do you think this is what I should have? This is nothing. This is the amount that I hope your daughters get." Meaning, in her eyes, it was this tiny amount. Rabbi Acha said, and we answered her, "Amen," meaning, if our daughters were so lucky that we would get this much wine. Now, the most famous story about Martha Bavaitis is in the Gemara in Gittin, where we have a whole cycle of stories that are called Agadot HaChorban, right? Stories about the destruction of the temple. This is where we have the stories of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. This is where we have the story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai going out of the city trying to save it. And in the middle of this cycle of stories, we hear about Martha Bavaitis. And how she goes from the highest heights to the lowest lows. Right? Martha Bavaitis was one of the wealthy women of Jerusalem. She sent out her agent, her servant, really, and said to him, "Go bring me fine flour." By the time he went, the flour was already sold. He came to her and said, "There is no fine flour. There's no solet. There's ordinary flour." She said, "Okay, go bring me ordinary flour." By the time he went, the ordinary flour was also sold. He said, "There is no ordinary flour. There's coarse flour." She said, "Bring me the coarse flour." By the time he went, that was already sold. "There's no coarse flour. There's barley flour," right? It keeps going down, 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 because there's nothing in the marketplace because there's a terrible siege on Jerusalem and a famine. She said, "Go bring me barley flour." But once again, by the time he went, the barley flour was sold. She had just removed her shoes. She said, "I will go out myself and see if I can find something to eat." She stepped on some dung, which stuck to her foot, and overcome by disgust, she died. And as she was dying, she took out her gold and silver and threw it in the marketplace. She said, "Why do I need this?" Now, it's a terrible story. And in and of itself, it's a very important story because we have this understanding that, first of all, Jerusalem, very much socioeconomic disparities. You have very rich people, very poor people, but in the revolt, it's all worthless, the money, because there's no food. And so we get this, she's a classic example of somebody who just falls to such a low place because of the revolt. But Gila Fine, in her book, actually very brilliantly, I think, and I'm not going to do it justice because I'm going to do it quickly, but again, I recommend reading it. She says, why is this story in the middle of the cycle about the Churban, about Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? And she says it's a microcosm of the macrocosm of the stories of the Churban. Okay? The beginning of the story, the servant is dithering. He should just buy whatever's in the marketplace, but he's so afraid that he's going to make her mad. He doesn't want to go and to do anything different. Beginning of the story with Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the rabbis are very afraid to, like, shake the status quo, to get anybody in trouble. They're very hesitant. And that brings us to a very bad place. Okay? the second section in the story, she goes out herself. She says, I'm not going to stay in the house anymore. I'm going to go see for myself. I'm going to go out. I'm going to see if I can escape and do something. The second part of the story, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, right? He goes out and he has to do something. His is positive, hers is negative, but it's the same idea. And finally, the end of the story, she recognizes that the gold, the silver, it's worthless to her at this point. What do I need this? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Mahavdil, he says, I can't, Jerusalem can't be saved. I can't have Jerusalem anymore, but if I can save something, if I can save the Chachamim, right? So she's kind of a counterpoint and a parallel, and it's really a very beautiful reading of these stories. Okay, stories that are maybe better known. Sorry, I had no good picture, so it's just a lot of text. But much better known is the story of Bruria and Rabbi Meir. There's a lot we could say about Bruria, and we're gonna only point out a few different things. One of them is that both Bruria and Rabbi Meir come from very complicated backgrounds. They are living in the time period of the Bar Kokhba revolt and right afterwards. Rabbi Meir, according to the Gemara in Gittin, this is also from the Agadah HaKorban, is descended from Nero, the Caesar, Nero, fiddling while Rome burns. Okay. According to the Gemara, Nero finds out that he is going to be God's weapon, God's tool to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. And then he knows that's not going to end well for him. So he flees and becomes a convert, and Rabbi Meir is descended from him. So Rabbi Meir is so important, such an important Tana, but he's a descendant of converts. A Bruria, on the other hand, she comes from a very different background. She's the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion. Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion was burnt by the Romans. He's one of the 10 martyrs, one of the Aseret Harugei Malchut. And we have this Gemara here in Avodah Zarah, sentenced him to death by means of burning. They sentenced his wife to execution by decapitation. And they sentenced his daughter, meaning Bruria's sister, was brought and put in, she was taken captive, and she was made to sit in a brothel. And then Rabbi Meir goes to save her, right? But they're coming from very complicated backgrounds, whether it's a convert, whether it's somebody who lost so many people with the persecution of the Romans. Hey, that's number one. Number two, Bruria is known as this very, very learned woman. Every time we hear about Bruria, she's besting the Chachamim in Torah. She's learning. And she has a very sharp tongue. She's often putting down those rabbis who kind of underestimate her. Hey, she learned 300 halachot in one day from 300 sages. She's known as somebody who is very, very, very learned, very unusual for the time period that we're talking about. That's why all so many girls' schools and learning programs are named for Bruria. And that's number two, second thing about her. And the third thing about her is that she has a lot of compassion. These three things don't necessarily seem to go together, right? And we have two stories here. One of them is people who were tormenting Rabbi Meir, and he wanted them to die, and Bruria says to him, don't say, it doesn't say, Yitamu Chotim me haaretz, the sinners should leave the world, but Yitamu Chataim, the sins should leave. You should pray that they should repent and not pray that they should die, right? So she has a lot of compassion. And then, of course, we have this very famous story which doesn't talk about Bruria by name. And is it someone else? Is it her? Different opinions. But that the two sons, their two sons die on Shabbat, and she waits for him to come home. She doesn't go tell him. She waits for him to make havdalah. And finally, she says to him, well, if somebody gave me a pikadon, if somebody gave me something to watch, do I have to give it back? And he says, of course you have to give it back. And she said, Hashem gave us this gift, and now we have to give it back, right? It's this very difficult story. She has so much nobility, and she has so much compassion for Bimeir. I think one of the lessons to learn from the stories of Bruria and Rabbi Meir is connected to the time period they're living in. They're living in a time period of Shmad. They're living in a time period where so many teachers and scholars are murdered by the Romans. We have, the heroic efforts to be somech, to ordain more rabbis. There's these gatherings to figure out the Torah and to pass it on, because you just have a huge destruction, right? Just to be anachronistic for a moment, it's a post-Holocaust world. And Rabbi Meir and Bruria say no Jew left behind, right? We talked last time about Acher and how Rabbi Meir learns from Acher. We have to learn from everybody we can. We have to connect to every Jew that we can connect to. And I think that's a thread running through these stories. Okay, we've got 5 minutes and three more stories. We're not going to get to all of them, but okay, we'll do a little bit. Rav Huna, hey, Rav Huna, second generation Babylonian Amora. He's all over the Gemara. He's Rav's student. He's the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura. He's a very comes from an important family, but he's very poor. Then he gets a blessing from Rav, and he becomes very rich. And he always takes care of the poor people, right? We have this great Gemara in Tanit. Every cloudy day, they would take him out in a golden carriage. He would survey the entire city. And he would command to tear down unstable walls, and he would have the owners build it. If he couldn't build it, the Rav Huna would build it from his own money. He would open his house and say, "Whoever needs, let him come and eat." Right? Very wonderful person, great scholar. We have a few stories about his wife, and his wife has a strange name. Her name is Chova. Chova, as in you're chayav of something. And really, two of the three stories we have about her, she is chayav. Okay, we have this guy named Rabbi Adar Bar Ava, Rav Huna's contemporary. He's a very zealous guy. He's always calling out people who are not doing the halacha properly. Okay, and here he says to Rav Huna, you gave this halacha about how you're not supposed to give your children a certain haircut. That's why I brought this great 70s haircut here, right? But your kids have this haircut. How is that possible if you're not allowed to? And Rav Huna says, "Oh, I don't do it. Chova, my wife, she does it." And Rav Adar Bar Hava gets very angry. He says, "Oh, well, she should bury her children." Right? So we have a very similar story in Bava Kamma. You, Rav Adar Bar Hava, sister of Huna, you said you shouldn't raise small livestock, and yet you do it. And Rav Huna again, he says, "Oh, no, it's not me, it's Chova." Right? So what's going on here? Why is he always placing the burden on her? Right? And she is always the one who comes out chayav or chayavet. It's a strange thing. I don't have really much of an answer. They're strange stories. But the last story that we have is that when Rav Huna dies, she comes into the court of Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman doesn't know what to do. Should he stand up for her? Should he not stand up for her? Is it the right thing to do? And then he kind of finds this strange way to distract people, and he stands up for her. But we see that she gets respect as the wife of a chaver, the wife of a Talmid Chacham. Okay, I'm going to skip my very last one, but I am going to do Yalta, because Yalta is great. And this is another Gila Fine story. Yalta was Rav Nachman's wife. She was an aristocrat. Okay? She came from an important household. It seems likely that she's from the household of the Exilarch of the Resh Galuta. She lives in an important household. Rav Nachman is a very well-known and important judge. She's wealthy. She's sophisticated. She's very intelligent. And she's used to being treated well. Right, so we have this Gemara in Beitza that Rav Nachman permitted Yalta to go out on a festival on a chair borne by poles. Okay, she gets special treatment. She clearly knows halacha. Okay, we have a whole series of things that she says in the Gemara in Chulin, that everything that God prohibited, he permitted to us a similar item. And she gives us a whole list. I only brought you one. He prohibited blood, he permitted liver. So she says to him, "I want to eat something that tastes like meat cooked in milk." So Rav Nachman says, "You know, you're right. There is something like that that you can eat. Roast udders on a spit." Okay, but she knows the halacha. Another story, Irinida. Right, she needs her blood to be seen. Is it tameh? Is it tahor? You're supposed to take the first answer that she gets, but she doesn't. He says she's impure. She brings it to someone else. He says it's pure. And the rabbis are not happy with this. And she says, no. I always bring blood of this color to Rabbi Bar Chana. He says it's pure. And now I know that he has problems with his eyes. So I knew he wasn't judging correctly. Okay. So she knows a lot of Torah. She's also very compassionate. Okay? She takes care of Rav Amram. She gives him, medicine. She helps to heal him. She's also very clever. She understands that Rav Yehuda is besting her husband, Rav Nachman, and she says to her husband, get out of here because this is not going well for you. And that's why we have this strange story in Gemara and Brachot, which seems to contradict all of these things, that she's smart, that she's diplomatic, that she's compassionate. We have this story where Ula comes to the house of Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman says, you have this kosher bracha, right? You're benching on a cup of wine. Pass the cup to Yalta. And Ula is very dismissive. She says, no, you don't need to do that because she doesn't need to get any special blessings. All of her blessings come from her husband. And this is the story that's most famous about Yalta. She gets up and she breaks 400 barrels of wine. She's so angry that she just goes and destroys, right? That's why I brought you these nice Roman wine jugs. And Rav Nachman says, maybe you should send her another cup of wine. And again, Ula says, all the wine is blessing. You don't need this special cup. And she just curses him out. She says, from itinerant peddlers, right? Ula was a traveler. He would go from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. From itinerant peddlers come meaningless words, and from rags come lice. And this is a story that's usually told as why this hot-headed woman, she's so mad, she's a shrew, how does she speak this way to the rabbis? And Gila Fine takes this story and she does a beautiful thing with it. Right? She says, in the biological understanding of the time, women are not the ones that children that are responsible for having children. You would think they would be, right? Women are merely the vessels. The main reason a woman has children is because she gets the seed from a man and she carries it around inside her, but she's not important. And that's what's going on here. Ula says, no. You're not the fruit of the body. You don't need the bracha. Only your husband needs the bracha because the fruit of the man is really what gives you the babies. And she says, you don't think vessels are important? I'll show you vessels, right? And she goes in and she takes the wine jugs and she smashes them. Well, maybe the wine is what's important, but without the vessels, you don't have any wine, right? And when Ula kind of doubles down, he says, no, there's nothing special about your vessel or any vessel. All the wine is the same wine. She says, you know what? We need both. The lice and the gossip, the words, those can come from only one person. But a child, you need both the vessel and the seed. And she's really using this method to teach him a lesson. So you could take it or leave it. I think it's really beautiful. I think it's great. And with that, I think we will end and take a look at comments, even though I had one more, but okay, we have to save something for if we ever do another course. This is the end of this course, by the way. And we will come back at some point. Don't worry. Impulsive. Who was impulsive? Or impetuous. Oh, you're giving me the word that I wanted before. Yeah, if Rav Yosef had a stroke, it's very. I read an article a long time ago. I don't remember the details of it anymore. But that talked about what he might have had, what disease he might have had. Yes. Okay. That is all. We don't have any other comments. Anybody have comments that they
Yes.
would like to add? Please. No? Okay, everybody. Chodesh Tov, Shabbat Shalom. We will meet again. Have no fear. Thank you, Nomi Chernov. I hope you heard the dedication. I see that you are here now. We did dedicate at the very beginning. All right. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you,
Julie. Great job.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.